From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd, in for Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Lights were dimmed and the mood was somber today as the Berlin Christmas market reopened. Police have installed concrete barriers to prevent vehicles from plowing through, as that truck did on Monday, killing 12 and more than 4 dozen others injured. The search for the suspected driver, a Tunisian named Anis Amri, continues. Police raided apartments linked to Amri in Berlin and the city of Dortmund. A refugee center in another German city was also searched. Authorities today confirmed that in addition to his wallet, his fingerprints have been found on the truck used in the attack. Danny Eberhard is a reporter for the BBC's Europe desk. He's in London. And Danny, talk about what police are saying today.
We've had a press conference from the Interior Minister, Thomas de Maizière, and he's confirmed that fingerprints were found in the truck. It's an important development. The German authorities have been quite tight-lipped up to now about what they do and don't know about the case. Most of what we're learning has been sourced in media reports. So that's a good concrete sign, according to the obviously that he was the attacker, and the authorities are increasingly convinced that the suspect is the person they're looking for.
Well, what else are we hearing besides the fact that he was arrested and released in August? Tell us more about what we're hearing.
Well, there was a very interesting development on Wednesday when a regional state minister confirmed that he was going to be deported, but they couldn't actually do this because he didn't have paperwork in order, and they tried to get confirmation from Tunisia that he was a Tunisian citizen, and Tunisia didn't actually send the paperwork through. It actually arrived this week. So this is why he was allowed to leave and evaded the attention of the authorities. He was kept under surveillance for a long period in the summer. He was suspected that of planning an attack. They thought perhaps he was going to carry out a robbery in order to buy weapons. But after a while, this was it looked like they didn't have enough evidence to support that theory. They saw that he had had some involvement with drug dealing. He was also involved in a barroom brawl. But the idea that he was going to launch an attack seemed to be deprioritized.
Well, the New York Times is reporting that he was on a U.S. no-fly list, that he had researched explosives online, had communicated with ISIS. There must be people, you know, very upset that, yes, yeah, sure, it's all circumstantial, but that he was then released.
The case has highlighted some real difficulties here for the German authorities. A senior politician in the governing CDU party, that's Chancellor Angela Merkel's party, has spoken of the failings in German security services, these domestic failings, in terms of passing information. Germany is a federal country, and the individual states have large responsibilities for security within their own areas. Now, it seems as though there was a problem in passing information between Nordrhein-Westfalia, which is an area where he was registered and where he briefly stayed in an asylum centre, and Berlin, which is where he spent a large period of his time. And Germany, I must say at this point, wasn't the only country that had difficulty deporting him. He had actually spent a time in jail in Italy, and the Italian authorities tried to deport him and likewise failed to do so, partly because, again, Tunisia failed initially to recognize him as a citizen of theirs.
Well, and the U.S., we've reported recently, has the same problem with undocumented immigrants in that often they cannot be deported if the country of origin will not allow them in. So that's a global problem. But meantime, what happens now? There is this manhunt. How much do we know about that?
We know, for example, that the borders have been tightened, especially in the northwest of the country. So we're talking about the borders between Germany and the Netherlands and Germany and Belgium. But there's also a wider European arrest warrant for Anis Amri. So the German authorities insist they're doing absolutely all they can. There's obviously fevered work behind the scenes to try to bring him to justice. That is Germany's chief priority at the moment. Their entire efforts are dedicated to catching the man.
One last question. There is speculation that if this is the truck driver and if this was an ISIS attack, he would normally make his way back to Syria and perhaps an ISIS stronghold, but that those have been reduced. What is your sense of ISIS's true involvement in this?
It's very difficult to say. We know at this stage that Anis Amri has connections with Islamists, with Salafi preachers, and But initially it seems as though he didn't grow up as a radical Islamist. This is, his family say that he was radicalized in Italy, possibly in prison, while he was there. His brother has spoken of a man who used to get drunk, used to do odd jobs, but there's no indication from his early background that he was highly involved in religion. So there's still lots of things to be clarified about how and why he was radicalized, if indeed that was the case. Islamic State have claimed responsibility for the attack, but at the moment the authorities haven't directly confirmed that.
Danny Eberhard of the BBC's Europe Desk. Danny, thank you.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much indeed.
There was never really any doubt that Hillary Clinton would win California in last month's election, but Donald Trump actually did manage to carry 24 mostly rural California counties. Scott Schaefer of Here and Now contributor KQED visited one of them, Kings County in central California's San Joaquin Valley, to hear what voters there expect from the new president.
At the Hanford Senior Center, two women are setting up for noontime bingo.
Okay, four for a dollar.
Okay, give me four. Okay.
And when a complete stranger walks into a small-town bingo hall with a radio microphone, well, there can be some resistance to talking politics.
No comment.
Me neither.
Bonnie Peters and Angie Dutra are longtime volunteers here, and eventually they warm up and are willing to talk about the presidential election. Dutra admits it was tough choosing a candidate to vote for.
I really had mixed feelings, you know, one way or another, didn't know which way to go.
Dutra's friend, Bonnie Peters, agrees.
I didn't believe in a lot of things Trump said, and I don't think he will follow through on what he promised.
Peters says she almost didn't vote at all. Both women are registered Republicans, and in the end, they both voted for Donald Trump. Despite her misgivings, Peters hopes he delivers on at least one thing.
I'm against letting too many foreigners come in, and Trump says he's not going to let that happen, but we'll see.
But you still have mixed feelings about him.
Oh, yes, and I probably will for the next 4 years.
Hanford is the county seat of Kings County, just south of Fresno. The economy here is driven by agriculture, including the dairy industry, which was hit hard by the recession. Around lunchtime on a recent Monday, about a dozen dairymen turned up for the weekly auction of cows. Joe Augusto quit the dairy business a few years ago. He complains that Democrats and Republicans are too cozy with big agriculture for little guys like him to make it. 8 years ago, he saw Barack Obama as the person to change business as usual. This time, it was Trump.
Yeah, I would like to see things shaken up, but I'm prepared to be disappointed because, you have people elected talk about hope and change and all change in general, and it usually doesn't happen. So I'm not getting my hopes up.
We go inside to get some lunch.
We're talking politics. You want
over
to talk
beef
politics.
Stew and Coca-Cola, Augusto's friend and fellow farmer, Joaquin Content, says he also voted for Obama 8 years ago, and this time for Trump.
Do you see something in Trump that you saw in Obama in 08?
Totally. They both seem to be disconnected from the establishment, and we'll see how far this guy goes forward with this disconnect.
His friend Joe Augusto admits it's a roll of the dice.
Most people voted for change, even though it could be wrong. And so I think I admit, and a lot of people admit, maybe he won't be a good president, but we're going to take a chance.
Both men dismiss Trump's most outrageous comments on things like building that wall and mass deportation. But Joaquin Content hopes Trump's plain talk helps broker deals on things like immigration reform so agriculture gets a more reliable and legal migrant workforce.
And this guy has the courage to step up and say those things that are kind of on the fringe of maybe it's not correct to say it, maybe it's not politically correct. I think it's going to be a refreshing change to have someone like that.
This region relies on immigrant workers, legal and illegal, and many Latinos are worried about Trump's threats of deportation. Even so, community organizer Pedro Ramirez says getting eligible Latinos to register and vote is like pulling teeth.
They don't really care about Democrats, Republicans, Trump, Clinton. They don't even know for the most part. They see it on TV, but to them it's just they're painted the same stripes.
Ramirez was brought to California illegally by his parents when he was 3. Today he's 28 and was the first undocumented student body president at Fresno State. He says there's a lot of apathy about politics here.
Because people here, I think, have been let down. They've made a lot of promises that have been made to them by a lot of people, whether they're in the local government, state government, or the federal government, and they see nothing changes.
With Trump taking over for President Obama next month, people here know things will change, but some are a little nervous about what exactly that change will be. For Here and Now, I'm Scott Schaefer in Hanford, California.
It's that time again. We're joined in the studio by our favorite Christmas elf, my former choir director from John F. Kennedy High School in Plainview, Long Island, Mr. Cohen, Mr. Christmas, they call him. Ron Cohen is here to take us through some selections as we do every year. Hi, Mr. Cohen.
Hi, Robin. It's so cool to be here with you.
So great to have you. In past years, we've listened to the sacred, you know, O Come, Emmanuel. We deconstructed A Mall in the Night Visitors. We'll put all of that at here.
Thank you kindly.
We'll put all that at herenow.org. But this year, you wanted secular music. Why?
I think what's very interesting and very relevant, Robin, is that the message is so universal. Fellowship, brotherhood, being kind to other people. I'm reminded of a quote by Norman Vincent Peale where he says, "Christmas waves a magic wand over the world, and behold, everything is softer and more beautiful." Mm. So I'm thinking to myself, why not do what we call a secular Christmas, of course, which is going to be more non-religious, less sacred, but more universal.
Well, and sacred to a lot of people. I'm reminded that one of your selections, we'll get to it, but White Christmas, written by Irving Berlin, and his daughter said, you know, he came from Russia. He was Jewish. He didn't even know about Christmas. To him, White Christmas was about America. So what have you got to start us off with?
I thought we would start off with It's Beginning to Look a Lot Like Christmas.
It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas everywhere you go.
I want to look back to the idea of when we had early television in black and white with Perry Como. Everybody watched it every Wednesday night. And we couldn't wait for the Christmas show. That song, which I believe was written around 1951, but do you know who wrote it?
Well, I only do because you told me. Meredith Wilson.
Meredith Wilson, who, da-da-da-dum-bum-bum. We think of the Music Man, you know? I was kind of shocked to find out this guy wrote this, and it's so cool.
Well, let's listen to a little more.
It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas everywhere you go.
Now there's a tree in the Grand Hotel,
one in the park as well,
the sturdy kind that doesn't mind the snow.
Here's another tidbit, Mr. Cohen, I found. There are people in Yarmouth, Nova Scotia, who believe that Wilson wrote the song while staying in the Grand Hotel in Yarmouth, because there's that lyric, a tree in the Grand Hotel, one in the park as well, and there's the park right across the street from the hotel. It's
another
so
thing,
cool.
A real quick point is that Perry Como recorded it with the Fontaine Sisters. Mm-hmm. It's a very big hit for him, and it's very cool.
Okay. So you have Perry Como. We're going to go to your next selection, and interesting, it became the next host of the show that everybody watched.
How great is this? Because when Perry Como finally left after a glorious run, along came Andy Williams, and it was again on Wednesday nights. It was again the same thing, and then it came to Christmas. He had a Christmas show, and he recorded It's the Most Wonderful Time of the Year.
It's the most wonderful time of the year. With the kids jingle belling and everyone telling you be of good cheer.
Now, want some interesting stuff about
this?
Number one, actually, it's about scary ghost stories, but that's been in disuse and in disfavor, except for A Christmas Carol, which continues to flourish. Also, it's about hosting parties, sledding, kissing under the mistletoe.
Well, I read that this song was actually written by George Weill and Edward Polo, but George Weill, in 1963, was the vocal director on the show. So this was just a fun song that he wrote for the show. As you said, had some goofy storylines. 30 years later, it was a standard.
Who could know?
It's the most wonderful time of the year.
Your next selection.
It's going to be the Christmas song, which is easily one of the most performed songs of all time.
chestnuts roasting on an open fire, Jack Frost nipping at your nose.
Written by Bob Wells and Mel Torme. Now, Mel Torme, to me, is underrated. I think he's up there.
As a singer.
This man could sing a ballad, and in my humble opinion, was a talent of the stature, in my opinion, of a Frank Sinatra.
Okay.
When he wrote the song, it was on a blistering, hot day in the summer, and he just couldn't take the heat, so he wanted to write something that would make him feel cool.
Cool. And combined with Bob Wells, I mean, the story that I read, he saw a pad at Bob Wells' house, and Bob Wells had written down four lines: chestnuts roasting, Jack Frost nipping, Yuletide carols, folks dressed up like Eskimos. Again, they were just trying to stay cool, and in 40 minutes they had a song.
They know that Santa's on his way. He's loaded lots of toys and goodies on his sleigh. And every mother's child is gonna spy to see if reindeer really know how to fly.
And so one of the things about these songs that we're playing is they are associated with iconic singers. And the one that's most associated with this one that I love is Nat King Cole.
Yeah. What's the next pick?
I'm going to do Baby, It's Cold Outside. And this was written by Frank Lessa, who's famous for Guys and Dolls. Mm-hmm. I'm the most happy fella. He wrote that too, that old score. So in 1949, my mom took me to see this film called Neptune's Daughter, and I got a crush on Esther Williams because she was this beautiful swimmer. Mm-hmm. And she came out of the water, and the wet Esther Williams sang with Ricardo Montalban.
I really can't stay.
Baby, it's cold outside.
I've got to go away.
Baby, it's cold outside.
So there's the version by Ricardo Montalban and Esther Williams. There was also another one from Red Skelton and Betty Garrett in that film, Neptune's Daughter. But the backstory here, apparently Frank Lesser wrote this and sang it with his wife, Lynn Garland, as a way of telling guests that the evening was over when they had big parties. And who knew? It became this huge song, and she got very upset, the wife, because he sold it to MGM. And at the time, she said, "I felt as betrayed as if I'd caught him in bed with another woman."
Ooh.
But he sold their song to MGM, and it appears in the film.
Do you know what else?
What?
It was recorded by Doris Day, Bing Crosby, Ella Fitzgerald, and Louis Jordan. But the one I really would like to hear, have the folks listen to, is the one by Michael Bublé and Idina Menzel, who played the Green Witch in Wicked.
I simply must go.
Baby, it's cold outside.
The answer is no.
But baby, it's cold outside.
The welcome has been.
How lucky that you
so
dropped in.
Nice and warm.
Okay, now we're coming to the one that I mentioned when we started. White Christmas, Bing Crosby, written by Irving Berlin.
It has become the best-selling single of all time, Robin, selling over 100 million singles.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know, where the treetops glisten and children listen to hear sleigh bells in the snow.
By the way, Irving Berlin, when he wrote this, he called the secretary and said, "Grab your pen and take down this song. I just wrote the best song I've ever written. Heck, I just wrote the best song anybody's ever written." And as you say, he was right. It was the most recorded.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Judy Garland.
Now, when I was a little boy, my mom took me to see Meet Me in St. Louis. I cannot watch that film to this day without getting verklempt.
Okay.
Because it's about everything that I love, family, and they didn't, and had little Margaret O'Brien. And then, of course, my mother tells me, "You were so little, and the first song you ever sang was, clang, clang, clang went the trolley, ding, ding, ding went the bells." Well, here's the deal. The family's husband, who's such a great family, he tells them he thinks it's going to be great. He wants to move to New York for another big job, and they are hysterically unhappy. And little Margaret O'Brien goes to the window.
Judy Garland's sister in the movie.
And she's trying not to cry, and Judy Garland tried to make her feel better about all this, and they're all upset. She sings, "Have yourself a merry little Christmas," and there's no one that I went to the audience that wasn't crying.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light.
Well, as our smackdown of trivia continues, this was written by Hugh Martin and Ralph Blaine. The first lyrics were, "Have yourself a merry little Christmas, it may be your last." They were very depressing. And so Judy Garland and Vincent Minnelli insisted that they be changed.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Make the Yuletide gay.
Wouldn't it be cool if we could bottle the Christmas spirit into jars? Full of love, kindness, courtesy, mutual respect. And then after Christmas and New Year's are over, and we get back to quote-unquote normal, we open the jars and release it every single day out to the world that maybe they could try to behave that way when it's not Christmas.
Well, you could have jars, or you could have songs, which do somewhat the same thing. That's Ron Cohen, Mr. Cohen, Mr. Christmas, my former choir director at John F. Kennedy High School on Long Island, and our regular visitor every Christmas to play some music this year, secular songs that have the spirit. Mr. Cohen, thank you so much as always.
You cannot believe how much I love to be with you.
If the fates allow.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron. Blue Apron knows that incredible ingredients make incredible meals, so they follow the highest quality standards and deliver recipes along with just the right amount of ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. New recipes are created each week by Blue Apron's culinary team, so you can customize your recipes each week. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. There's no weekly commitment, so pick what you want at blueapron.com/here.
There is bias in hiring. We know that. It's in all kinds of sectors, from business to technology to law. But now a new study finds that social class matters when law school students seek internships at top-tier law firms, very top. That, in fact, a higher economic background actually hurts women, while it helps men get more interviews. They're also 4 times more likely to get interviews than all other applicants, be they women or men. Kurt Nikisch is senior editor at Harvard Business Review. He joins us. Hi, Kurt.
Hey, Robin.
So how is this study done? It's not as if people are putting their parents' income on their resume, so...
Yeah, so researchers basically sent a few hundred fake applications to very elite law firms, like what's known as the 1% of law firms. These pay a lot just for internships in the summer.
Mm-hmm. How much, by the way?
Like 6 figures.
Oh, wow. Okay.
These mock candidates, they all had the same GPA. They had the same qualifications, such as being on the law review at their schools. But they differed when it came to class cues. Names were different. So high-class applicants were given names like Cabot instead of Clark. And extracurricular activities were things like playing polo and sailing and not track and field or mentoring first-generation college students, things like that, which were assigned to lower economic class applicants.
They put in these social cues in these, and what happened?
Well, they found that that men from high classes were preferred 16 times as likely as a man from a lower class, for instance. But it was a penalty for women. So there's a big difference in classes. High economic classes were preferred at elite law firms, but it didn't necessarily help women.
Women. And why do you think that is? I mean, is it just plain bias?
Well, the researchers went out and interviewed hiring people at these law firms and asked them. And they said that women, even though they were seen as a better fit culturally for sort of the clientele that they work with and the culture of these elite law firms, that they were more of a flight risk, that they were afraid that they didn't have the commitment to sort of put in the long hours that were required, and that's why they
because
prefer
they
men
have
over women.
Family.
Exactly. Or they come from – the other thing some people said is they come from they come from wealthy families, and so they maybe didn't need to work so hard. Maybe they're married to somebody who is well off anyway.
Oh, man. Well, so you have that. You have the bias against women in general, but you have the bias against people from maybe a lower economic background who, you know, are just going to have this barrier. But I'm thinking, too, it's going to create law firms that are bubbles, bubbles of the people who think the same, go to the same polo clubs. I mean— It's just, it can't be healthy. What can be done? And did you get a sense that there is a desire to do something to remedy this?
Yeah. So first, I mean, that's a really good point. So when it comes to who you're trying to hire, what kind of company, what kind of organization you're trying to be, there are a lot of questions you can ask about sort of your efforts for who you reach out to and who you want to bring in. But the other thing you can do is just ask yourself, what do we want to measure? If we're measuring work, maybe let's take off extracurricular activities. Maybe let's change the names on a resume to just initials so that we really focus on what we're actually trying to get.
I'm thinking, too, we're almost out of time, but these are law students. They could sue. Kurt Nikisch, senior editor of Harvard Business Review. Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
For a lot of people, this time of year is all about tradition. But for one family in Pennsylvania, this holiday season will be all about firsts. They were reunited after nearly 50 years apart. Paige Flager of The Pulse at Here Now contributor WHYY reports.
Keith Murphy is 52 now, but he still remembers the day decades earlier that changed his life.
Sitting at a kitchen table one day when I was almost around 16, my dad came in the door drunk, and he just went off on this wild tirade. And he proceeded to put his finger on my mother's face and said, why don't you tell him about Greg, is what he called him. And that was the very first time I found out that I actually had a brother.
Keith collected clues from his father's drunken episodes. Eventually, he pieced together the story behind his long-lost younger brother, a story that began on the day that Keith was born in 1964. Here's his mom, Nancy Oakes DeWitt.
Well, I was a 16-year-old unwed mother. Living at home with my parents, madly in love with his father. Neither one of us old enough to get married, and if we could get married, and how would we support each other? And so I had Keith. I brought him home and raised him with my parents' help.
How did your parents react to that?
To Keith? Mm-hmm. Well, they were furious when I told him I was pregnant, but they loved him. I mean, and they helped raise him, and they were wonderful to him.
They were kind to him, but told Nancy that if she got pregnant again, they would take Keith away from her and send her to girls' reformatory school. And a few years later, she got pregnant again. She was scared, so she hid it for 9 months. The night of September 18th, 1966, Nancy went into labor in the backseat of her car. Her boyfriend, Patrick, who was just 17 at the time, delivered the baby himself. It was a boy. He cut the umbilical cord and tied it off with a shoelace. He then wrapped the baby in white towels and left him in a random car parked outside of a New Jersey bowling alley.
I've given away my baby. And it's a place I don't want to ever have to go through again. It doesn't get any easier with time.
Nancy didn't look at or hold the baby. She never told anyone. She and Patrick got married soon after and had two daughters and another son. But their life wasn't what she had expected it to be.
I never dreamed my life with Patrick and my other kids would be so hard.
This was one of the catalysts for his alcoholism, the guilt. My mom found religion, my dad found the bottle.
While his family was crumbling, Keith embarked on a search. He looked for police reports, adoption records, news articles, anything that might lead him to the brother that his parents had given up. But after decades of dead ends, Keith lost hope. Then, About a year ago, he got a strange notification from Ancestry.com. He had taken a DNA test in order to sort out his ethnicity and put together his family tree.
The results came in, and you look at the ethnicity at the top, and I'm like, okay, 65% British. You scroll down to your direct connections. And lo and behold, I found Scott Winter 17 as a direct either sibling or grandparent. And just knowing that all my grandparents had passed away, it just basically meant that he was a direct sibling.
So he did what any self-respecting 21st century person would do. He stalked every single Scott Winter on Facebook, sending them all the same message.
Scott, my name is Keith Murphy. I'm looking for Scott Winter 17 from Ancestry.com. And I believe that if you are him, we are brothers.
Across the country in California, 49-year-old Scott Winter was having what he thought was going to be a pretty typical day. He woke up, got ready for work, and checked his Facebook. He had a message from someone named Keith Murphy. He read it and then checked his Ancestry.com account. Sure enough, there was a notification that said he had been matched with a brother.
And I remember standing, looking at my computer in disbelief for probably like 10 minutes going, you know, is this a trick? Is somebody playing with me? I mean, it took me about another 5 or 10 minutes to actually dial his number. I remember standing there, my hand was shaking. I finally dialed in his number and I didn't hit send for about another 10 minutes because I'm like, man, I got to be prepared for this. So
I still remember the very first phone call. I answered the phone. He goes, Keith. I go, yes. He goes, this is Scott. And I said, oh, man, I was waiting for this phone call for all my life.
Keith and Scott discovered that they have a lot of similarities. They're both in sales, grew up in the same part of New Jersey, and share an obsession for shoes and peanut butter. The biggest difference between the two was the kind of life that they had growing up.
I know the childhood my children had, my four children that I had, and they did not have what you would call a normal childhood. And I was certain that Scott would have a more normal childhood than the other four. And to this day, I think he probably had the best childhood of any of them.
His adoptive parents are just amazing, amazing people. I mean, if you look at, like, who may have had the better upbringing, it's... You know, I think he won the lottery on that.
Scott had a happy life, but one of the most difficult parts of his childhood was all of the questions that he had when he found out he was adopted.
You know, do I have siblings and what are they like? And, you know, with relation to your biological mother, I always wondered, you know, on key dates, you know, like birthday, Christmas, stuff like that, you know, is she out there thinking about me or, you know, just... You know, on one hand, you're kind of cast aside. So you always wonder, okay, am I at least in their thoughts?
These last 49 years, very painful. His birthday, Christmas. The first few years when you saw a little one running around that would have been his age, you always wondered, I wonder if that's mine. And so, yes, it was very painful.
But this holiday season, 50 years after Scott was left in a car at a bowling alley, the family is reunited. Scott lives in California now, but when he last came east, the family took the opportunity to celebrate together. The father, Patrick Murphy, died a few years ago, so it was just Nancy and all of her children, Keith, Scott, and their younger siblings, Lene, Charles, and Jeanette. It was a full house.
You know, we had Halloween, Thanksgiving, and Christmas yesterday. Our first one together.
So. All three in one day.
Yeah.
What does that look like?
It was a mess.
Look at the back. Oh, yeah, well, the back.
I had Christmas in one section. Yeah. We had a Thanksgiving dinner. We had Halloween in another section. But, you know, it's like trying to make up for lost time. That can never happen.
Well, and you guys squeezed in 49 birthdays on me when I was...
Yeah.
When we first met, they came out with a birthday cake with all these candles on it. And they start singing Happy Birthday, and I'm looking around going, whose birthday is it? And because it wasn't even close to my birthday. And I don't know what I was thinking. I went out and I bought a lottery ticket after all this happened. And obviously I didn't win. Otherwise we'd be having this interview down in Jamaica or something. But I'm like, what am I thinking? I already hit the lottery.
They talk like this for a while, huddled together on a couch. This is only the second time that they've all been together, but they don't look like strangers. They look like family. For Here and Now, I'm Paige Flager.
Well, a lot of people are making their pilgrimage home this weekend. Today is the unofficial start of the annual travel rush. AAA is reporting that 103 million Americans will be traveling between now and January 2nd. That is the largest number on record. Airports, of course, will be crowded, but most Americans will be driving, about 93 million of them, compared to the 6 million who plan to fly. And if you're staying home, well, data from the Waze driving app from last holiday season show the most popular destination on Christmas Eve is the grocery store. Trips to the store were up 34% from days that weren't holidays. So get out there early, grab your turkey, get your prime rib, grab your latkes, because who wants to stand in line on a holiday?
And now to that story that Walmart has agreed to remove from its online sales sweatshirts and T-shirts that say bulletproof above the slogan Black Lives Matter. The Fraternal Order of Police, the largest police organization in the country, protested the clothing and asked that the shirts with the word bulletproof and those with just a Black Lives Matter slogan be removed. Now, they're made by a contractor, but Walmart has removed T-shirts before, including those with the Confederate flag, and they agreed to remove those with the bulletproof slogan, but not with the Black Lives Matter. Chuck Canterbury is national president of the National Fraternal Order of Police. He wrote the letter to Walmart requesting the change. So, Chuck, we're a country that has free speech. It allows T-shirts with some of the most degrading language possible. Why shouldn't Walmart be able to sell something that has the word bulletproof?
We took an exception to especially the bulletproof slogan because it's very insightful. This year alone, 8 police officers have been shot in the line of duty by people that took some of the rhetoric to the extreme, and we objected to it. We do very much appreciate Walmart taking down bulletproof. A number of my members are not happy that they're not going to take down Black Lives Matter, but we do understand the First Amendment, and we are the first line of protection for America's right to free speech. Just as in Dallas, those 5 officers were killed protecting Black Lives Matter protesters.
Well, and many of those protesters ran to their aid, but you are right to point out that it has been a terrible year. I think this is the worst in 10 years for shootings of police. Then there was the April 2014 finding by the U.S. Department of Justice that the Albuquerque, New Mexico Police Department engaged in a pattern or practice of use of excessive force, including deadly force. There was then a finding in December of 2014 that said pretty much the same thing about Cleveland. In March of 2015, the DOJ issued a report of clear racial disparities and discriminatory intent on the part of the Ferguson, Missouri Police Department. Isn't a T-shirt maybe the safest and simplest way to vent anger that people might have at those reports?
Show me what the slogan bulletproof does to improve relations between the community and law enforcement. You just named 4 police departments. There's 18,600 police departments in the United States. And for the Justice Department in the last 8 years to investigate 19 police departments based on complaints, that's a very, very small percentage of our nation's law enforcement officers. And so those figures, although raw figures, look damning. If I work in a depressed area and the majority of the people I put in jail happen to be of color, somebody has to look at the fact that 80% of my patrol beat is in a minority area. You can't judge on raw numbers.
Well, look, you just mentioned something else as well. You're addressing the concerns of 2 communities in your letter to Walmart, the police community, but also the minority community. As you say, commercializing our differences will not help our local police and communities to build greater trust and respect. Turning a buck on strained relationships will not contribute to the healing process. This should be a time for joy, and no family has lost a son or daughter, whether in the line of duty or in a tragic event, should have their pain turned into someone else's profit. Do you feel you're also speaking for those who've lost lives in encounters with police?
Absolutely. These are commercial vendors that are selling T-shirts. They're, as far as we know, there's no association with any legitimate advocacy group. This is strictly to make a buck. And they have the First Amendment rights, but we don't have to agree with them. And we have the right, through free speech, to tell them that we don't like it. And social responsibility starts with everybody. And that's why we appreciate Walmart taking down the bulletproof. And I'm sure that they will continue to monitor anything else. I mean, Pigs in a Blanket has been sold on T-shirts and hats. And there are people that will make their living trying to interfere with the relationships between law enforcement and the communities we police.
Look, as long as I have you, can you clarify? The Fraternal Order of Police had a document. It was addressed to the Trump administration, and it listed potential actions through executive order or action for—
It was not addressed to the Trump administration.
It was, okay. It appeared to be. Clarify. It appeared to be, for those who haven't seen it, it appears to be addressed to the Trump administration. It says the first 100 days. And it listed everything that, everything from rescinding an executive order, limiting spending on local, for local forces to— federal agencies supporting research into medical marijuana. People took that as a Christmas wish list from your group to the Trump administration. You say what?
People didn't take it that way. The media reported it that way. And what we like to call are the fake news stories, because no mainstream media.
I got to tell you, I'm looking at it. It doesn't look like a wish list. It looks as if you've laid out what the Trump administration, because of what they have said in the past, might do.
That's exactly what it says. It's a predictive summary of potential actions by the Trump administration. There are things on there that we support and have advocated for, but there's a number of things on there that we won't support.
Yeah. Well, we've cleared that up. Chuck Canterbury.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Chuck Canterbury, National President of the National Fraternal Order of Police. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So again, it was just a document documenting what the administration might do in the first 100 days, not what the police hope that they do. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.